Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Taishi Fukuyama from Crates. But first of all, let's look at some news from last week. Deezer launched in the United States. Now, what is Deezer, you might ask? Deezer is actually Spotify's biggest competitor in Europe. The company's been around since 2007, but only now is it launching in the United States. Well, that's not really true. It launched in the United States last year, but only the high-res tier that was available either on a Bose system or on a Sonos system. So if you didn't have either one of those and you didn't want to pay $19.99 a month, you weren't going to get it. Now, that said, now it's available for $10 a month, and there's no free tier, only a 30-day trial period. And again, this is something that artists and songwriters, labels, managers really love. Not so much, though, for the average consumer who really wants to get free music. That being said, there's not much that really sets Deezer apart from all the competition. And that, in fact, is the big problem here. Deezer has a nice user interface. I don't know if it's enough that it will make people want to go there. It does look pretty slick. And the fact of the matter is, it has 40 million songs and 40,000 podcasts, which is quite a bit more than you find most other streaming services. By the way, Deezer also owns Move Music, which is once part of AT&T's free music plan. And Deezer came in and bought that. And Deezer also bought Stitcher, which, again, is basically made up of podcasts, including this one. So that's why it starts in the United States at 40,000 podcasts, quite a lot, actually, because it owns Stitcher. So anyway, look out for Deezer. It's interesting. It's been around for a while. It already has 3.3 million paid subscribers, and I've actually seen figures that have gone as high as 6 million paid subscribers. That being said, since it's been around for a while, it does mean it does have some legs. There's something to it because there's lots of people who could have jumped by this time, especially in Europe. By the way, it's in 180 countries around the world, so the United States is basically the last country in the world that it's jumping into. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses on bobbyosinskicourses.com. You might want to check out my music industry and music production blogs too. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. The next thing is, I'm sad to report that Fairlight is going out of business. Fairlight was one of the pioneers of digital music. Now, what I mean by that is the Fairlight was one of the very first digital computer-based instruments. As a matter of fact, the instrument was called the Fairlight CMI, Computer Music Instrument. And really, it's the sound of the early 80s. If you listen to Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush, Jan Hammer, anything that Trevor Horn is producing, Thomas Dolby, Art of Noise, they're all using the sampling keyboard called the CMI. And as a matter of fact, what was interesting, it was the first computer keyboard that actually had a computer monitor that was connected to it. So this was a groundbreaking instrument. It was, again, the sound of the early 80s. And eventually, it was expensive. It was $25,000 to $30,000. And of course, the only people who could afford it were celebrities. And there's only so many of those. Even back in the 80s when budgets were high, after a while, there's only so many you can sell at that price. So what ended up happening was Fairlight went out of business. And about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it came back one more time. This is an Australian company, by the way. Fairlight's out of Australia. And this time concentrated on post-production, audio post-production, and made some wonderful gear. All Fairlight gear has always been incredibly well-made, heavy-duty, just very reliable. And the fact of the matter is, they made some great gear. But they're also out of the mainstream somewhat, being out of Australia, and I think that really hurt them in the long run. So now they just posted a press release basically saying, come and buy us, we're now for sale. Give us a bid on our assets. So it's a sad day to see Fairlight go away. My guest today is Taishi Fukuyama, who's the chief marketing officer for Crates, a unique online service that supplies small orders of vinyl records in short amount of time. Basically, shorter amounts of time than if you placed an order with a pressing plant. Crates also has a very unique crowdfunding element that's built in the service to where the order isn't really placed until you have enough sales, which is very cool. I spoke with Taishi recently from his office in Japan. I want to know about Crates. Where did the idea come from?
Oh, okay. So our company, we launched the service last year. So the service itself is about a year and a couple months in. And originally, we had a separate product, which is like a beat port. So we were always very much into electronic music, underground club kind of stuff, which is obviously very heavily linked to vinyl. And seeing how much interest and growth and resurgence there is in the market, it was kind of a natural progression for us to pursue this idea.
Now, you're in Japan, and I see that on your website, most of the prices are in British pounds.
Oh, yeah. We're seeing a lot of traffic from definitely, UK, a lot from the US as well. And, anywhere where they're talking about vinyl and the revival of it, we're getting traffic from, I think.
Okay. I'm in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work then? Do you have local pressing plants here, or is there, where do you press it, and then is there a charge for shipping?
So currently our business model is based, actually let me go back. So we are pressing primarily in the Czech Republic with GZN Media, but our kind of secret sauce is that we have a network of trusted plants that we work with. And this means that depending on, for example, how much of a turnaround time any specific pressing plant is operating at, or let's say logistically, it would be more strategically, optimized shipping cost if we were to ship elsewhere. That's when we would tap into those resources and make sure that whenever we press, you're getting high quality records at the lowest shipping cost and also the fastest turnaround time possible.
So the whole idea here is you can place an order for 100 copies, right?
That's right.
Do you do less than 100, or is 100 the minimum?
Currently the 100 is the minimum. And we have a couple ways to, meet that threshold. For example, we're kind of known for the crowdfunding bit of it, where obviously artists and labels can come in with no money up front, put up a crowdfunding project, and once you have 100 records met, we'll press them and ship them either back to you, meaning the label or the artist, or we can also fulfill them straight directly to all the individual backers. And our third offering is we call store delivery, where we have physical retailers in our network that are participating in the crowdfunding or the pre-order project. So that means if you're an artist or a label, you can set your wholesale price and sell your records directly to, for example, HMV in Japan or Juno in UK, Fat Beats in New York. And we have about 200 retailers within the network combing for records.
Now, that is cool. The crowdfunding.
Thanks.
The two parts there, the crowdfunding, which I was going to ask you about, that's a great idea, implementing that. What was it like putting the infrastructure together for that? Because already you have impressive infrastructure for just taking the orders and doing the vinyl, but then you have these other pieces here. The crowdfunding is a whole separate infrastructure that you have to put on, right?
Yes, it's definitely not a simple feat, I guess, meaning that, crowdfunding is one beast in its own, and also doing like supply chain management and manufacturing, like the production side of that and the support of logistics. It's a quite a big operation, but we've managed to kind of analyze that process. And traditionally, where if you were an artist, you'd have to really go through a phone book and see like where to actually press, and then you end up finding out that there's a broker involved, and maybe the broker will give you a quote that takes some time, and it takes months to actually get it pressed, and then it's a very complicated process. And I think a lot of the DIY and the smaller independent labels have all experienced this. So our mission was to, how do we consolidate, how do we collapse that value chain and make it really simple, where you can come to our website, upload your artwork and final ready masters, and as you, it's a WYSIWYG editor, so as you update all of, or go through the process, you can get a dynamically updating quote on like how much it's going to, how much your record's going to cost if you do splatter or transparent, or maybe you're going to do heavy vinyl, or, and then it's very transparent, and then it's basically you just click through and then you have a crowdfunding project up in minutes.
I went through it myself. I went through a design and it's very slick. It's very easy.
Right.
As you say, it's simple. It's to the point. It tells you everything you need to know. So congratulations on that, because it could have been much more of a difficult process than you've made it. It's cool. It's great.
Thank you. I mean, if anything, we think it's still a little bit too complicated and we're trying to make it simple as possible. But at the same time, you know, every record, we want it to be a really unique thing. So, you know, at this time, we're getting a lot of lots of questions like, can you do double vinyl, lyric sheets, downloads, and all these things. And the truth is that we can do that. But once we start like baking in all those options into the WYSIWYG and making the steps, making more steps until you complete your process, you know, there's drop off. And so we're kind of looking at our numbers and seeing like what to implement first, I guess.
What's the largest order you ever received?
So currently our menu right now goes up to 1,000. Not sure like which project off the top of my head has the largest, but we do see, you know, funding projects with 500 pop up and get fulfilled pretty often, actually.
But even so, 500, that's a good number for you, but if you're looking at a pressing plant and a normal order that you'd go through, they look at 500 as barely worth doing in many cases. So it's very cool that you can pull this off, especially down to 100 copies. That's great. What happens with the metal parts?
Metal parts, meaning the genre or?
No. So
the plates and stuff.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I think like, the best person to talk to within our company is our COO, who's head of operations and production. So, because I'm sure there's a lot of details in there where labels can ask for various detailed things. What we can say is like, if you want test pressings, it does take a little bit of more time. Right now, we're turning around delivering vinyl in an average like 6 to 7, 8 weeks. If you want test pressings and it takes like, I think, 2 more weeks to do that.
Okay. And what happens for a reorder then?
So right now, when you come to our site and set up a project, you can pretty much, opposed to a traditional crowdfunding project where there's a set date, we've set up ours so it doesn't end. So pretty much, let's say you set it up for 300 copies. So once the first 300 get fulfilled, that gets pressed and fulfilled. And then you can just keep on going as much as you like. We made it on demand as much as possible, I guess.
Yeah, I understand that. So then what increments do you press in?
Oh, so it would have to be still in the increments that we're providing right now, which is 100, okay. 2, 3. Yeah. I mean, we'll try to work as manually and, you know, one-to-one as possible, but if there's our specific inquiries, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. What are you looking for in terms of a master? I say that because being on the audio production end, I know how critical it is, and knowing many mastering engineers, I know what they do to make a different master from the CD master, for instance, one that works for vinyl. So are you giving instructions as to what should happen, or are you just taking it come as may, or how does that work?
No, we definitely, we don't give instructions in a way that like we act as a mastering facility per se, but we do have like a partner mastering studio that does provide vinyl mastering services, and we're actually in the process of kind of building out that part of our business as well, so artists can come to our site and look at different mastering services. And because right now we do offer mastering from Color Studio, and you know, there are obviously great vinyl mastering engineers and studios out there, so it'd be great to work with them to be able to offer their services through what we have right now.
Does anyone ever send you a lacquer master for pressing?
We don't work in that way right now.
Okay.
Basically, all you upload your vinyl-ready audio files.
Who would you say your customer is, if you looked at an average?
So, okay, an average, the majority would probably be independent artists. The second tier and third would be like smaller labels. And I think the interesting thing is that we've had music blogs use our platform as well. So this means like, well, the specific one that comes to my mind right now is a blog called Noon Pacific. Great site, by the way, and they publish playlists every time at noontime Pacific Standard. And they've taken their playlists and pressed up a vinyl and taken their online digital presence and through us taken it offline and physical and analog. And I think that was a 500 copy, like a limited thing, but that went really quick. And we've seen a lot of comments wanting like a volume 2 for that.
So are most of your clients doing the crowdfunding part? Is that the main bulk of your users?
Yeah, so we do crowdfunding, which is obviously no money up front and press and fulfill after you reach your goal. And we also do the other way around, which is pre-ordering, which is you come up with the funds first and we'll press the records and then you can sell as many as you want. The third option is we do offer our platform just kind of like a e-commerce cart where you can just sell your back catalog if you have inventory.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and if you want to have the records shipped back to you, you can, you know, bundle them with merch and do upsells, and we allow you to upload thumbnails of whatever you want, really like t-shirts or posters, so you can sell bundles of merchandise as well.
So it takes 6 to 8 weeks then to receive product if someone placed an order and they're looking for the product to come back. They're not doing the crowdfunding part. You're not fulfilling for them. What takes the longest there? Is it the printing or is it the pressing?
I think it's really case to case where, you know, depending on the label and how responsive they are. So that's kind of where the average is. And perhaps, you know, at any given season, the partners that we work with may be at different capacities. So don't have a one sentence answer for that one. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. How do you think that your business will be affected? Your business mm-hmm. model will be affected considering that now there's going to be some new pressing plants or new press, record presses. First time in 35 years, there's going to be new presses coming online. How is that going to affect your business model?
Well, if anything, it reinforces it, I think, because with this really crazy bottleneck of production and it was just a natural progression that manufacturing capacities increase. And as that does, our core competence is in definitely the production and the detail in fulfillment and because when I say that, our crowdfunding aspect is competitive with XYZ. You know, you can line up any crowdfunding platform. But the truth is that if you don't have the just-in-time production aspect of it, it's really hard to go to any crowdfunding platform right now and just raise a bunch of money and say, well, I'll figure out how to press and ship and do all that later by myself.
Yeah.
So it's really, our strength is definitely in the fact that we have the ability to do the heavy lifting production side of things. And as we have the options to press faster and cheaper and closer to where our customers are, it just makes us more nimble and able to move faster, I guess.
You know, I didn't realize looking at your website, I didn't realize how integral a part the crowdfunding was. I mean, it's there and it's obvious and you can see it, but really it's the whole package that makes it unique when you look at this. It's the 100 minimum copies, you know, minimum order and everything. That's true. When I look at your website, that's what jumps out at me. But yet, mm-hmm. in talking to you, what I'm feeling is that the crowdfunding portion is a huge part of this. The whole bundle together, that's what makes what you're doing unique.
Yes, I think it is definitely one of our strengths. The fact that we're doing very much close to like an on-demand vinyl is what makes us unique, I think, as well. And right as a in a broader goal for us, we've actually launched a auxiliary service lately called Vinylize It. And what this is it's crowdsourcing kind of flipped on its head, meaning for crates, our target users would be the artists and labels that want to make their crowdfunding or pre-order projects. With Vinylize It, we've made a service where SoundCloud users, this means like your regular listeners and fans, can select tracks on SoundCloud and say, hey, it'd be great to have this track on vinyl. And they would put up a project on Vinylize It, basically. And what that does is that it aggregates demand. So let's say if you're an artist and so your fan puts up a Vinylize It project up on our platform, and then it aggregates 20 or 30 people that want that track on vinyl. We can go ahead and contact that artist and say, hey, guess what? We've already got 20, 30 people waiting for your record on vinyl. Why don't you just flip on the switch? It's pretty much turnkey on crates to start that process. So we've already pre-populated demand, given you the tools to make it very easy to create pre-order or a crowdfunding platform, and hopefully it'll be a head start or like for artists and labels to test out these new waters with vinyl.
That's a great idea. The only thing I can think of that's a little difficult there would be the licensing aspect, but if it's mostly a DIY artist, a new artist, that actually should make it easy. As long as you don't have managers and publishers in between and labels in between, you know, it's a whole lot easier.
Yeah, and the thing is that SoundCloud makes that a very, what's the right word? So SoundCloud, because it is a UGC platform, you know, like your bedroom artists and DJs and producers can upload their own tracks versus, you know, you don't have to have like a, I don't know, like a UPC or like the proper
an ISRC code and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Yeah.
To upload to the other streaming services. So it's like the beginning of a broader experiment for us with Vinylize It. But that's we're seeing as we've tested the waters with crowdfunding and integrating store delivery with our retail partners, and we're seeing more and more that in the future our tools will have to play with different entities. And I think that's kind of a trend in general with like a lot of these on-demand services.
That's a great idea. Vinylize It. Mm-hmm. Is it vinylizeit.com?
It's vinylize.it.
Vinylize.it. Okay, that's very cool. Okay, you just mentioned something about ISRC codes and UPC codes. That's one thing I don't remember seeing actually on the order form. How do you deal with that?
Oh, you just upload it, actually. We do have a in the process where you upload that if you, you know, assuming that you have those. We don't have any services that get them for you.
Yeah.
So you would have that. You would have to have that yourself and upload that.
Okay, you can't employ it though.
No, we don't do that at the moment.
One of the things that happens with a lot of pressing plants that I've dealt with is you have to have the ISRC codes or you can't go through with the order. And the other thing I remember is they made you sign a document that basically indemnifies them and basically says, yes, I own the copyright to this or I have the right to press it.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, do you have something like that as well?
Yes, basically a similar policy where as a user of our service, you're completely compliant with the copyrights of what you're publishing.
Yeah, it's especially difficult because you're not talking one market. You're talking a worldwide market, so it's really every market, which that legally, that's a tough one there, I would imagine.
Well, you know, it's definitely ongoing issue for us as we scale. Like, how do we make that as bulletproof as possible? You know, it's definitely an issue that we're very, very seriously talking about internally, and how to make that compliant and as possible. Yeah, for sure.
What were you doing before that? Just out of curiosity.
Okay, no. So I started my career as a songwriter producer in Japan, writing for Japanese and Korean pop acts for the major labels. And after that, in Japan, and then seeing the iPhone launch in 2007, was it, I think, kind of quickly realized that everything's going to change, and became more interested in the technology side of things. And Japan is a very Galapagos kind of an island, where we have a silo of technology, not really, you know, it kind of works, it operates independently of the world, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. So as, you know, the trend was going to be iOS and Android, I was consulting and doing business development for a lot of music tech that was promising outside of Japan, and launching them in Japan.
So did Crates begin in Japan then?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So yeah, just to give you a little bit of, so past clients of mine were like the Echo Nest, which got by Spotify. And so I was representing their services in Japan, doing Japanese deals and stuff like that.
You speak terrific English. And it's
Thank you.
Very good. You don't have an accent.
I try to keep it as much as possible.
Did you spend time in the States?
Yes, I pretty much grew up on the East Coast.
Well, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So, why did you move back to Japan then?
Well, I'm not sure if this is an interesting story, but so pretty much my childhood I spent on the East Coast, and I never had lived in Japan at all. And I figured if I missed the opportunity to go there for my university years, I probably wouldn't go at all. So I studied economics in Japan and ended up in the music industry over there, which I guess isn't the most natural progression of things, but just the way it happened, I guess.
What was the transition like? Was it difficult for you?
Moving to Japan for the first time?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was a mind-boggling experience. Culturally shocked in every way, and especially because I looked the part, and I just wasn't the part, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was definitely hard to fit in for a while. Maybe that kind of was what made me go into the music industry in a bit. But yeah, it's especially living in the New York and that area where, you know, there's so much culture there, and everyone has a very strong kind of identity with their roots. I've always had a itching to kind of figure out what that meant for me and what Japan was like and what it would be like to live there, I guess.
Did you have a language problem when you moved back in terms of dialect or an accent or something like that?
Well, I would say that my Japanese definitely did improve while I lived there. But it's not like I couldn't speak it. But as I started my career professionally and meeting lots of people, and because there's different types of Japanese, you know, like in the business scene, in the casual sense, and when you talk to your elders, and there's lots of variations of Japanese and intricacies, so it's hard to learn that unless you really live there, I guess.
And how about the music scene? It's far different there than it is in the States. How did you mm-hmm. find that your adaptation to the music scene there?
So as a record producer, I was doing the tracks and doing the programming and recording vocals, and I've never written the lyrics for any Japanese releases that I did. I've always worked with someone else that did that, but I don't know. It didn't really feel like a adapting thing, because I never my career started in Japan. So if it were the other way around, maybe I would have had something to kind of fall back on, but yeah.
Yeah, but you grew up immersed in American music, though.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, I guess there's a sort of a culture shock with that as well, you know, because I know just going from country to country and listening to the music and listening to the symbiosis with Western music to whatever is, you know, local, It's always interesting. There's always something that I find very cool about it. But I haven't been in Japan, so I don't know what it's like there. And I'm just from the music that I've heard there, it just seems like it's it's not as open to outside cultures in a way. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. I think a lot of Japanese music, the most recent of it, is very, like you say, domesticated, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But my producer days were kind of around like 2005 and to like 7 years after that or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like a streak of like kind of how everything was a little bit hip hop or urban, like the pop tracks, and there was a lot of influence.
Yeah.
So like being able to catch up on the latest trends and like the snares and the kicks and how tracks were being laid and because you know I listened to that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that was an advantage for me at the time.
Yeah.
But right now, as you say, like Japanese music is very domestic oriented market. I think the international catalog is I don't want to say any wrong stats, but like less than 15% or something.
That's what I've heard too, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, you say you also wrote for Korea too. So again, that I can't imagine that. Well, maybe it is the same. I don't know. Tell me what's
so
different.
The Korean acts that I've worked with were Korean acts that released in Japan.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it's a little bit different, yeah.
Okay.
So they're just nationally Korean, but their releases were in Japan, yeah.
Yeah, you weren't going the opposite way. You weren't trying to create for Korea then, right?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, because that seems like that would be a, you know, kind of a reach.
Yeah, I think it's a very different approach because I think a lot of people have said this already, but a lot of the K-pop that has succeeded globally was like inherently because their domestic market wasn't really big enough, and they were forced to look abroad and sell their music elsewhere. Whereas in Japan, the domestic market is relatively large enough where a lot of the labels and artists themselves don't have much of a natural interest in international markets.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
I get it. Okay. Last question, mm-hmm. question, Teishi.
Sure.
What's the best piece of business advice or music business advice or music advice that you received along the way from someone or else you learned yourself?
Okay. Well, I think this is like something that I try to work on like all the time, but is be punctual because like it's hard to be punctual like every day and you know every moment. So, but when you do, well, I think a lot of things just tend to go better. So it's a very basic thing, but kind of sticks to my head. But music business advice, especially with you know in the context of Creates, what we're doing right now, is that with vinyl, it makes looking for your top 16% of your super fans much easier. Look into I would say if you're a label and artist and maybe it's been difficult to figure out how to press vinyl at a small scale or maybe you're a archive manager at a bigger label and you've only been able to put in your efforts around a couple key artists. I think as technologies and tools evolve, especially with the things that we're doing, we're allowing catalog managers to monetize their longer tail of music. And I think that's really exciting because the next generation of vinyl consumers are really 13 to 24 and they're really young and without the opportunity to get this vast, you know, archive of music that we should have access to, it would really be a unfortunate thing, you know. And we hope that as we propose vinyl on demand, it opens up opportunities for kind of every record that's been on vinyl before repressed and out there back again.
Well, it's a very cool idea, I have to say, and very well implemented. So I'm sure Creates is going to do very well as the word gets out more and more. Teishi, thanks.
Thank you
so much for being with me today. Thanks for taking the time, and I do appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
To find out more about crates, go to crates.com. That's crates.com, crates.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.